From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Teenagers are sometimes held in solitary confinement for far too long while awaiting adult charges in the Baltimore City Detention Center. That's according to a scathing new review by the U.S. Justice Department. We talk about it with Kara Annenson, a juvenile justice advocate with the nonprofit Just Kids Partnership. Then, how does the media shape what we think of Islam? Tom Hall speaks with a Muslim activist and an Al Jazeera America host about how Muslims are portrayed in the media.
These questions of where is the quote-unquote moderate Muslim, right? Like, we're unicorns. Like, apparently we're like the Bigfoot. You can barely find us.
Plus, theater critic Jaywin Russick reviews After the Revolution. Playwright Amy Herzog's study of a family propelled by Marxist politics, now up at Center Stage. First News.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
Good morning. This is Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Federal prosecutors have warned Maryland corrections officials to fix serious problems in how juveniles are treated at the Baltimore City Detention Center. Especially, the prosecutors said, teenagers awaiting trial on adult charges are often held in solitary confinement for weeks or months, putting the youth at risk for behavioral or mental problems. The prosecutors said there have been improvements at the detention center, but that its disciplinary process remains, quote, seriously flawed, close quote, its staff not adequately trained, and its treatment and programming for the young people in its control very limited. The Maryland Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, which runs the detention center, responded with a statement that says in part, quote, the department takes these issues very seriously and is committed to drastically improving the overall environment for juveniles charged as adults and committed to our care, close quote. But the department declined to discuss the situation with us. We are going to discuss it with Kara Annenson, Director of Advocacy for the Just Kids Partnership, a nonprofit that campaigns to change conditions for youth charged as adults in Maryland. This assessment of deficiencies at the Baltimore City Detention Center was made in a letter February 19th from the Civil Rights Division of the U.S. Justice Department. It's based on an investigation by the federal lawyers last summer, which grew out of a settlement the state and feds reached 8 years ago to improve conditions for juveniles at the jail. Kara, you've been working on this issue for about 4 years. What do you think, what to you is the most important point the federal prosecutors made?
I think the most important point that the federal prosecutors made is that jail is not a place for kids, and that no matter what we do to try and fix jails, they're never going to be an appropriate place to place kids.
Well, why are there juveniles in jail in Baltimore?
So in Maryland, youth can be automatically charged as adults between the ages of 14 to 17 if they're accused of one of 33 offenses. So what this means is police on the street are allowed to charge a youth as an adult if they're accused of one of these crimes.
They have to be charged as an adult, or they can be charged?
They have to be. That's what the statute says.
Okay. And is any juvenile charged as an adult held in the detention center?
Correct. So any youth who is automatically charged as an adult has to be held in adult jail. They are, in fact, an adult.
For the purposes of the law.
Correct.
So what puts a kid in solitary confinement?
So there are a lot of reasons that kids end up in solitary confinement. Sometimes if it's behavior in the juvenile unit, maybe they are acting out. Maybe they need to be protected from other kids. So these are the things that lead to kids being put in solitary confinement.
And the federal lawyers gave examples of one teen being held in solitary for more than 20 weeks, another more than 7 weeks, one 6 weeks, one 5 weeks. Is that the pattern you see?
Absolutely. We see kids held in solitary confinement for long periods of time at the Baltimore City Detention Center and detention centers across our state. Baltimore City is unique because it has a special unit for kids who are charged as adults, but other jurisdictions, actually, this is the practice they use for every kid that comes into their facility. They're held in protective custody or solitary confinement, whatever that jail calls it, but that means that they're in a cell for 23 hours a day and out only one.
Yeah, tell me more about what conditions are like in the Baltimore City Detention Center in solitary confinement.
So kids in solitary confinement are held in a box. They're in there for 23 hours a day. They're not allowed out to go to school. Very rarely do they see any other people. They get their food through the little slot. They don't even interact with guards. We had one of the kids that we work with actually spent 7 months in solitary confinement when he was...
7 months. Why?
He had a riot broke out at the school, and so he was told that he was going to be there for 7 days. The guards then lost his ticket, and he ended up being there for 7 months.
Lost his tickets?
Yeah.
So the guards told him, we don't know how long you're supposed to stay.
Correct.
And wasn't anybody trying to answer that question?
No. I mean, he would beg and plead. He flooded his cell to try and get some attention so people would know that he was in there. He would punch the walls. He would do anything to try and get the guards' attention so that they would let him out. But he spent 7 months there. And once the administrators found out, he said he was taken to a room with the... And they apologized, but he spent 7 months there. There's nothing you can give a child back for being, caged up like an animal. That's what he called it for 7 months.
And what's he like today? Well, first of all, what happened to his case?
So his case was actually ultimately sent back to the juvenile court, and then it was dismissed. So he was actually found not guilty for what he had spent 11 months total at the Baltimore City Detention Center and 7 months in solitary confinement. And right now he's, doing well. He's enrolled at Baltimore County Community College, and he's working. But, he has a really hard time being in any room with the door closed. He likes to be pacing around. He's very fidgety. It's hard to have a conversation without him moving because, he was so confined for so long.
That's Kara Annenson, Director of Advocacy for the nonprofit Just Kids Partnership, here on Maryland Morning at 8:01. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about a recent critique from the U.S. Justice Department of the treatment of juveniles in the Baltimore City Detention Center. The federal lawyers called the use of solitary, which they call seclusion, misguided. They wrote, quote, "Separating juveniles and housing them in isolated, harsh conditions merely suppresses behavior on a temporary basis. In the long term, such practices may result in mental deterioration, lead juveniles to engage in self-harm, or exacerbate behavioral issues," close quote. Is that what you see?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Kids are often, come back worse from being in those situations.
Well, the federal prosecutor said that on average 80 days pass after the incident that puts a teenager in solitary confinement before there is a hearing about whether that was the right thing to do. Why so long?
I think that the jail process is just backed up. It's an administrative hearing that the jail conducts on themselves. So that means that they have to, review those cases, and they're not doing that in a timely fashion.
I want to ask about training. The federal lawyers who visited last August said only two staff at the detention center had been given specialized training mm-hmm. to work with juveniles. Excuse me. The department, in the statement they gave us on Friday, said there's a training program, quote, in the works, close quote, and that 30 corrections officers who work with juveniles have completed training in areas like crisis prevention, handling trauma, social development. What do you see in terms of training?
I think that is true. I think that they're working to train their staff to be better able to manage this population. But I think the reality is that we already have a system to deal with this population. It's the juvenile justice system, right? We shouldn't need to train guards in the adult system to deal with kids. We already have a system set up in the state of Maryland to deal with this population. And that's why we have been putting forth legislation to move these kids from adult jails into juvenile detention facilities.
Yeah, tell me what, there is legislation that has passed the House, 129-8, 2 weeks ago. Can you tell me briefly what it would do?
Sure. What this bill would do would allow kids who are automatically charged as adults to be held in juvenile detention centers pre-trial. Until they have their transfer hearing. And so this bill would not apply only to kids in Baltimore City, but it would be a statewide policy. So kids could get the access to services, treatment, education, trauma-informed care that they receive in the Department of Juvenile Services instead of being held in isolation.
So essentially this would change the law that you talked about at the very beginning of this conversation, that children charged with certain crimes have to be charged as adults and they have to be held in jail.
This deals with the second part of that. So it just deals with where they're held. They're still charged as an adult, but it's just dealing with where they're held. Hopefully, eventually, we'll change the law so we're not charging youth as adults at all.
So it's passed the House. What's the outlook in the Senate?
So we're really hopeful that the president of the Senate, and Chairman Zirkin will take this important issue up and vote on it this week. That's what we're hopeful for.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on it. Kara, thank you.
Thank you.
Kara Annenson, Director of Advocacy for the Just Kids Partnership, a nonprofit that works to improve conditions for juveniles charged as adults in Maryland. At our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, we've got the Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services written response, as well as links to the Just Kids Partnership website and the Justice Department's February 19th letter.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up, Maryland Morning theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews the first of two plays in the Amy Herzog Festival at Baltimore's Center Stage. But first, it's time for this month's edition of Living Questions, our series in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. We're producing this series in partnership with the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. And in a couple of weeks, we'll be partnering with ICJS at a public panel that takes up this important question: what role does the media play in shaping our perceptions of Islam, and how is it shaping religious discourse? My guests this morning are the two featured speakers on that panel, which will take place April 15th at the Park School. Rabia Chowdhury is an attorney and a National Security Fellow at the New America Foundation. Wajahat Ali is a playwright and the co-host and digital producer of Al Jazeera America's The Stream. On April 15th, along with the resident scholars at ICJS, they'll be discussing the topic, Being Muslim in America, Why Media Matters. This morning, Rabia Chowdhury joins me on the phone from her home in Baltimore, and Wajahat Ali joins us on the phone from Al Jazeera in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us.
So, Wajahat, you wrote a piece, a report, with a few other people for the Center for American Progress called Fear Incorporated, The Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. And you identified literally a handful of people who are dedicated, it appears, to spreading misinformation about Islam and Muslim Americans. Tell us what you found in your research.
Yes, it was a six-month investigation that I did for the Center for American Progress, and the report, like you mentioned, Fear Incorporated, was the first time that we really connected the money to the small, interconnected, incestuous group of players that have been responsible for promoting many of the anti-Muslim memes that first existed on the fringe, and especially after the 2010 Ground Zero Mosque controversy that was neither at Ground Zero nor a mosque, kind of catapulted it into the mainstream, if you will. And what we found out from a six-month investigation is essentially the Islamophobia Network, what we call it, is a tightly connected group of funders, the Nerve Center, who we call the Islamophobia Scholars and Think Tanks, most of them in D.C., who then create many of these memes and these documents that get spread vis-a-vis the third group, which is the grassroots networks like Act for America, which then gets amplified, which is in the fourth group, the mainstream media, and then finally ends up quite literally as talking points in the mouths of politicians, which is the fifth group. And I'll give you one quick example. The anti-Sharia legislation, American Law for American Courts, has entered 32 states in the past few years, passed in several. And if people are wondering, well, where did this come from? Is this a groundswell of like millions of Americans who one day woke up and said, oh my God, Sharia is a threat to America? Nope. We traced it, and it was quite literally started from a think tank, Frank Gaffney, Center for Security Policy. His attorney, David Yerushalmi, then created the model draft of the anti-Sharia bill, quite literally hand-delivered to state senators and congressmen by Act for America, the grassroots groups. And then a lot of these individuals, you saw them on talk radio, you see them on Fox News, you see them on online media, trumping it up this fear that Sharia is apparently a threat to America. And it quite literally ended up in the mouths of nearly every single, Tom, Republican presidential candidate of 2012, except, of course, for Mitt Romney. We have to give him credit for not riding that fake boogeyman train. But it was quite literally in the mouths of Newt Gingrich, Herman Cain, Michelle Bachmann, Tim Pawlenty, and Rick Santorum. And it's still in the mouths of, very well-known popular Republican elected officials such as Bobby Jindal, governor of Louisiana, who just recently said there are apparently, quote-unquote, no-go zones in America. These, you know, Sharia-infested zones where Muslims have apparently taken over and replaced the McDonald's arches with minarets, and apparently the Statue of Liberty is wearing the burqa. I make joke of it, but essentially that's what we saw, is that these, you know, international memes, and it's, you know, the local becomes the national, becomes the international in this day and age of Twitter and social media. These memes were quite literally created, like you said, by a handful of people.
And Rabia Chowdhury, a lot of people know you from the podcast Serial, because you've taken up the cause of Adnan Syed. And between 1980 and 2005, 94% of terrorism in the United States was committed by non-Muslims. You have offered training to Muslims on how to address the fear, because along with the fact that a vast majority of the terrorists activity is committed by non-Muslims, two-thirds of the media coverage about Islam is negative. When you train Muslims to address this problem, what do you tell them?
Well, you know, I mean, part of the issue is, I mean, as Wajahat articulated really great, is, you know, this incredibly well-coordinated mechanism for propagating memes that, like, then stick, right? I mean, that's what a meme is, that sticks. And American Muslims, by and large, have really failed at producing counter memes or positive memes that then stick. You know, like we've been saying the same, Islam is a religion of peace, for about 30 years, and it's not sticking and it's not working. And part of the problem is, while it's true that in terms of, like, terrorism statistics, I mean, when you look globally, I mean, according to Homeland Security officials, like 0.00125% of global Muslims are actual terrorists, or they're actually engaged in some kind of violent extremism, they're fighting in Syria, Iraq, what have you. It's just a small number, but those folks also get a lot of power because they tend to echo the same kinds of narratives that folks in the Islamophobia Network do. And in the middle, all the 99.999 go on percent of Muslims, their narratives, their voices, their work, the ethos of their life, how they view their faith, all of that gets lost. We have tried really hard, especially since 9/11, to organize in a way that we are able to successfully create counter-narratives, and not just counter-narratives, but actually authentic narratives of what Muslims are about and what Islam is about, and haven't been very successful. A lot of that has been frustration with the media. You know, I mean, it's, you know, the conventional wisdom is, if it bleeds, it leads. So nobody wants necessarily the positive stories. What's been fascinating for me through Serial is that, first of all, we have a story that, for the first time, it's a very, very well-known story of a young Muslim man that it's not connected to terrorism. So that's kind of a new framework for looking at a Muslim community or a young Muslim man. But also that, you know, we kind of bypassed mainstream media. I started blogging about it when the podcast launched, and the mainstream media came to us, and it became about the stories of people. And most people were completely unconcerned about his religion. In fact, they were very, very turned off by the fact that the state used the religion against him back in 1999. So some of the lessons, you know, I've learned is that, number one, Muslims have to be better at telling their stories as human beings and not necessarily putting religion first. That, you know, we tend to say, I'm a Muslim in X, I'm a Muslim in X. You kind of don't need to do that. You can just tell your story, and people may or may not know you're a Muslim, but, you know, that can be in the background. It doesn't have to be the, you know, what you put forward first. The second is the power of social media and how we can actually bypass all of the mainstream media that has frustrated us for years because we can't get attention, and tell our stories directly to the public. I don't know how successfully we can replicate that. You know, if you look at Serial as a model or the response to Serial, but I think it has to, at least we have to try it.
Rabia Chowdhury is an attorney and a national security fellow at the New America Foundation. She writes a blog called Split the Moon. Wajahat Ali is a playwright and the co-host and digital producer of Al Jazeera America's The Stream. You're listening to Living Questions, part of Marilyn Morning here on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. So, Wajahat, rhetoric matters, obviously. The term radical Islam is thrown around quite frequently. You mentioned in the report that you wrote a few years ago that very few mention the term Christian terrorist, for example, when they were talking about Anders Breivik, the guy in Norway who murdered some, you know, more than 70 people. But you also point out that he cited as an influence many of these people that you've profiled in this report. part of this, what you referred to as the Islamophobia network. When it comes to this rhetoric, what is the way to, and of course the White House convened this thing called the Countering Violent Extremism. The president has even taken some heat for not using the word, you know, Muslim extremists or Islamist extremists. What is the proper way we should frame what's going on with the people who are committing acts of terrorism in the name of Islam?
That's a very good question. I think what many minority communities, especially those who feel marginalized, especially in mainstream media, or those who don't have access to, say, power, such as Muslim Americans, what we want is we don't want a double standard. We want a uniform standard, right? So, for example, when a violent act happens, the first prayer of any minority community is, please God, just let it be a white guy. Let it be a white guy. Let it be a white guy. Let it not be a Muslim, right? The reason being is we realize if it is a Muslim, the labeling happens, the knee-jerk scapegoating, the very inelegant lumping, if you will, and these questions of where is the quote-unquote moderate Muslim, right? Like we're unicorns. Like apparently we're like the Bigfoot. You can barely find us. And I think that's why even the framing of it shapes the discourse and shapes the understanding of the diversity of American Muslim experiences and also Islam. And that's why I think President Obama, I have to give him credit for being very elegant and I think consistent in his language, being very nuanced. And I think what he says, basically, and the CVE experts say, is if you look at the DNA of many of these individuals who are committing these acts, the DNA is shared across the line by others who commit violent extremism. So by essentially ceding ground to, if you basically call them Islamic terrorists and only Islamic terrorists, and you make this double standard, whereas for Anders Breivik, who quite literally committed acts of terrorism, you know, you could call him a lone wolf, right? But you don't call him a terrorist. Some people don't. Whenever there's a Muslim, there seems to be an automatic assumption, oh, has to be terrorist. And I think by calling it violent extremism, you take away the sensationalism, number one, you ground it in the reality of what it is. The DNA of violent extremism is essentially the same across the board. No one's denying that Muslims aren't doing this in the sense that these people aren't Muslim or say they're not Muslim. I don't think Robbie or myself have ever, you know, been propagandists or been apologists for this. But I think it is important to have the proper framing of it. And secondly, the reason why the framing is very important is the number one recruitment tool and propaganda tool of violent extremists like Al-Qaeda of the Arabian Peninsula or even ISIS, known as ISIL, is that the West is at war with Islam. That's their number one recruitment tool. That's the number one propaganda. So if you even give the framing as Muslim terrorist or Islamic terrorist, you kind of give them a legitimacy that they do not have within Islam or in the understanding of the overwhelming majority of Muslim communities worldwide. You want to defang that, and you want to essentially neuter that and strip them of that type of legitimacy that they seek to claim and rationalize by using and abusing religious language. I hope that makes sense.
It does. And Rabia Chaudhry, we're almost out of time, but just briefly, what do you think mainstream media can do better then, assuming that, you know, social media isn't going to be able to have quite yet the reach that mainstream media will have?
I think what mainstream media can do better definitely is to, for example, when you're talking about acts of violent extremism or terrorism, give fair coverage. If we know that the majority of perps in this country, at least, are not Muslim, where is the coverage on those cases? It is extremely skewed towards coverage of Muslim perps, and then on top of that, there's a quick leap to frame it as terrorism, even if later, for example, Major Nidal Hassan from, he was not even charged with terrorism, he was charged with workplace violence. But, you know, he became a terrorist, and this just reinforces the idea that this is, like, a pervasive, overwhelming issue in the Muslim community when it's really not. And it also puts Muslims in a very defensive stance where even something like, this, you know, this White House initiative on CVE becomes extremely controversial in our communities because there are legitimate civil liberties concerns, and they just get exacerbated when people feel cornered. So if the mainstream media had coverage that was much more balanced on the kinds of things that happen, you know, you have right-wing extremists and these, you know, white militias that are really a much, much bigger threat to the country than Muslim terrorists, and they need to get the same kind of coverage, or greater coverage, if not the same.
Rabia Chaudhry is an attorney and national security fellow at the New America Foundation. Her blog is called Split the Moon. Wajahat Ali is a playwright and the co-host and digital producer of Al Jazeera America's The Stream. Thanks to you both, and we look forward to seeing you on the 15th.
Thanks so much. much.
Thanks so much for having us.
And we will continue this conversation April 15th at 7 o'clock at the Wyman Arts Center on the campus of the Park School in North Baltimore. The panel will include Dr. Humaira Ziad, Dr. Benjamin Sachs, and Dr. Heather Miller-Rubens, the resident scholars at the Institute for Christian and Jewish Studies. This event is free, and you are very welcome to join us. Come to our website, wypr.org/livingquestions, for a link to further details. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. You've been listening to the latest installment in our series, Living Questions, produced by WYPR in partnership with the ICJS, in which we examine the role of religion in the public sphere. You can hear the other conversations in our Living Questions series when you visit our website. Again, the address is wypr.org/livingquestions. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead on Maryland Morning.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
The next two offerings from Baltimore's Center Stage are plays by the American playwright Amy Herzog. Our theater critic J. Wynn Russick has been to see the first one, and she's brought us this review.
The word revolution crops up three times in the play After the Revolution. Each time it refers to a much-anticipated political revolution. But another type of revolution reverberates throughout Amy Herzog's 2010 play, a revolution within a family. After the Revolution is one of two plays by Herzog inspired by her own radical left-wing family. Both it and 4,000 Miles have been produced across the country, but Center Stage is the first theater to produce them together, in repertory. Part one of the Herzog Festival, After the Revolution, is on stage now. Part two, 4,000 Miles, begins previews Wednesday. The semi-autobiographical Joseph family figures into both plays. The family's revered patriarch, Joe Joseph, was a member of the Communist Party. He was blacklisted during Senator McCarthy's witch hunts for the House Un-American Activities Committee in the 1950s. Joe's a hero to his widow, grown children, and especially to Emma, his granddaughter and the protagonist of After the Revolution. This red diaper grandchild heads a legal fund she named for her grandfather. The fund is dedicated to combating an unjust system that punishes, quote, vocal progressives, as she puts it. Emma is living out what she sees as her late grandfather's ideals. Then a long-buried fact surfaces about Grandpa Joe's political activities. It's part of a book that's about to be published. Emma's father, Ben, played by Ari Gross, and his brother, Leo, played by Mark Zeisler, realize the impact that this revelation could have on Emma, and the fund to which she has dedicated her life.
But let's not dwell on that, and we need to be making a plan.
You know, actually, I would like to dwell on it for a minute. It's Dad. It's Dad's name.
And Emma has been invoking Dad's name publicly for the last 4 years. There's going to be some consequences. I don't think you understand.
I understand
what's
going
on.
Kill her. I understand very well.
But they don't realize the rift this information will cause between Emma and her father. Herzog's writing and the intense portrayals of Ari Gross and Ashton Hyle as father and daughter demonstrate how similar these two are. Both are given to speechifying, both are passionate about politics and Joe Joseph's legacy, and both are unwilling to back down. When Emma stops speaking to her father, Gross movingly conveys Ben's sadness, tinged with anger, particularly in the messages he leaves on Emma's voicemail. Emma appears to be the only family member who is unaware of what she sees as a serious stain on her grandfather's history. Her step-grandmother, Vera, played by a stern Lois Markle, is distressed about the book that's coming out, but she hates the messenger, not the message.
And I hoped we could talk about Grandpa Joe.
Sure. We can talk about Joe.
I'm not sure how much my dad told you.
He told me about that filthy book. I know all about it. It's the first time in a year and a half that I'm glad Joe is gone, so he didn't need to see that. It's disgusting. It's just disgusting, Emma.
Judging from her vehemence, Grandma Vera can be as headstrong as Emma. Director Lila Neugebauer makes most of the familial connections credible and strong, though the depictions of Emma's uncle and sister seem out of sync, almost disengaged. And while Ashton Hyle captures Emma's fervor, She can't do much with a script that barely allows her character to budge, much less grow. Designer Daniel Zimmerman's set also presents difficulties. The set is a wide living room that does multiple duty as Grandma Vera's apartment, Emma's parents' home, Emma's apartment, her sister's apartment, her uncle's house, and a restaurant. Zimmerman may have intended his unchanging design to remind us that this is one family unit, but in practice, the set often leaves us wondering where we are. Amy Herzog is an award-winning playwright who has been absent from Baltimore's theaters until now. As the local introduction to her work, After the Revolution places Herzog firmly in the midst of a growing trend of American political playwrights. Center Stage's production isn't quite satisfying or unsettling, more the response I suspect the playwright intended. But the Josephs are a smart, challenging, and vexing bunch, and I look forward to spending more time with members of this spiky clan in 4,000 miles.
Amy Herzog's After the Revolution is at Center Stage in Baltimore until May 17th. The next play in the Amy Herzog Festival is called 4,000 Miles. It goes into previews Wednesday night. We've got details on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews plays for us every Monday morning here on Maryland Morning.